All right, now that we are all here, let's bring this meeting to order.
Yes.
It is the wrong date on top there.
I'm sorry.
February 7th, 2012. New reports at Conservation Commission. This meeting is being recorded. Yeah, you like that?
Obviously.
Yes, it is.
From the King's Speech?
Hmm?
Is that from the King's Speech?
No.
You can't see the big microphone.
I didn't even see that. All right. First item are the minutes from January 17th. Any comments or changes?
Motion to approve.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
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 Opposed? Okay. Number two is the wetlands ordinance. Those who read Andy's email know that we have a date with City Council on Thursday night with the Planning and Development Committee.
7 o'clock.
It is 7 o'clock, I believe. Yep.
In this room.
I assume it's in this room.
Yes. Just so you know, the committee might be a little late between two of the committees, so I'm not sure if one of them finishes early. We'll be following right after them in this room, but they're both posted in this room. I'm hoping that the first one finishes and the council starts that. We might be a little later than that. But he'll be here. So,
Andy, you wanted some anecdotal stuff.
Well, we have a couple of council sponsors, obviously. I think Julie's going to mention a couple of things today, just to sort of take a look at the language. But, the ordinance for the council, and your goal is not to get the ordinance adopted, regulations go to follow, this is typically towards after that. So, the goal is to get the council to approve the ordinance so you have the authority to deal with things like the local buffers and those terms and whatnot, from additional protection that are in there, and then move forward with regulations. Stormwater can be dealt with in the regulations. It might be worth, I don't know how much time I was spending, but it might be worth looking through some of the language things that Joanna was just talking about. Mm-hmm. I think it really comes down to partly for the council and partly for you as you're looking at applications is how flexible you are when things don't fit in the perfect box of always being outside the number story area particularly. So, for instance, we're talking about a subject waterfront. I mean, that's an area where you wouldn't expect, for instance, with boardwalk, for there to be grass going right up to the water there, you have for boardwalk. That would be a man-made structure for coverage, structure of some kind up against the water. So just recognizing that there may be some cases that don't perfectly fit in the no-disturb zone requirement. So having enough flexibility in the language itself and also in your own perception of the applications coming forward to understand that sometimes there's a need for flexibility that things don't always fit perfectly in that. So we talked a little about things like that also. There's some language that it talks about. I think this would be a particular concern of council too, because I think when you get support for wanting to protect the wetlands and the buffers, they want to make sure there's flexibility to deal with situations that don't perfectly fit in there. Whether it be residents, constituents, or business owners, that if you had, for instance, a particular waterfront, you get a lot of coverage out of that pavement, you've got buildings and so forth, someone redevelops, it wouldn't make any sense to say, well, you got to preserve all that as grass space too. Might make sense to have them replace the coverage with some other type of coverage. Maybe it's a building, maybe it's some parking, or more likely in our case, moving forward, is a walking trail. So, in the ordinance, we talked about a 4 foot width for paths along that riverfront area. I think it makes sense for us to allow something like put the Clipper City Rail Trail, it's a wider path, it's like an 8 to 10 foot path. And part of that is because Mass Highway requires those standards for these public passes, they probably get struck with. But also, 4 feet is not very wide for a lot of things like wheelchair, pass on all the wheelchair and so forth. So we just need to keep in mind there's a need for flexibility, and to the extent that you want to change any language in the ordinance itself, forget the regulations in the ordinance prior to adoption, now is the time to take one last look at that to make sure that we have, you're not sort of tying your own hands, you have the flexibility to deal with those situations. So, I don't know if Julie would have anything.
No, you just covered. You pretty much covered it. Yeah, just to make sure that the language in the ordinance doesn't prohibit some of the things that we might actually want to have happen down on the waterfront to create the kind of active downtown waterfront area that we have and we want to expand a little bit. So, think about some scenarios that might come up.
Sorry to interrupt. Yeah. Just like an example of that would be, for instance, to me is, you know, you've got the Clover City Rail Trail, for instance, the Harbor Walk. That's a walkway that goes along the waterfront. You could even have a grass strip with some plantings in between the walk, but in this case, we have a water edge. The National Grid site, you know, we've been talking to National Grid about getting the public access to go through not only the development properties, lying through the Waterfront Trust and NRA area, going through that, again, through NED, New Orleans area. The Coast Guard station, we have an easement going through that property. So we're trying to make the whole connection, of course, for the phase two of the Clover City Rail Trail. And one of the issues we have, of course, with the National Grid site is we'd like to have the walkway as close as possible to the water. That, of course, you know, could be perceived as sort of going into that no disturb area that we want. At the same time, it's actually, for a number of reasons, ends up being the most beneficial place to have it. It's partly, you know, pushed and mandated or certainly advocated by the Chapter 91 regulations that be close to the water. So, you know, it's an example right there where on the National Grid site, we have a grassed area, it's got some vegetation, sort of scrub vegetation. I don't know that really provides a whole lot of habitat, but it is definitely vegetation that's there. And I'm not sure that, you know, frankly, anything to do with the rail trail is going to involve some plantings and, you know, other amenities that go with that. It's probably going to be an improvement of the situation that's there, but at the same time, we have more public coming. If you look at just the strip of adjacent to the water, they would have asphalt going through there. And so we just have to keep in mind that that may not necessarily be a bad thing, but on an isolated, you know, basis, a specific type of project.
Something like that. That's going to get covered in the waiver, though. With there's going to be public
interest.
Yeah.
Right, but if it's, let's say it's not the rail trail pathway, the multi-use pathway. Let's say it's a private developer car for someone else who's trying to do something as part of a larger waterfront plan down there. Is this going to prohibit? Is this going to stop everybody in their tracks for something that we, the city, actually wants to have happen? Just need to think about possible scenarios that we might end up getting stuck with.
Right.
Yeah. I don't know.
I think the language right now can be read to be broad enough to cover those things. Yeah. I just think there needs to be certainly clarity and understanding that that's what it's
the intent
to address those things. Because if, you know, if somebody comes in and tries to do something on the waterfront, that whether it's the city or a private entity, like it could be new development or some other entity, the NRA, you know, providing public access, they're putting pavement in that, you know, jurisdiction. And of course, I don't think we want to be in a position to be saying, no, you can't do that because it violates, you know, the perfect line drawn in sort of arbitrary space. Clearly, in most cases throughout the city, we don't really need, the people don't need the flexibility to have to go in there. We should have, you know, a buffer of some kind. But it's part of the waterfront like this, and what this waterfront is intended to do in terms of interaction on both sides, to have that, you know, well in the middle of nowhere. Pond, it's clear, it's very easy to, I think, to have those separations. You know, if we're going, if we were to redevelop some of the suburbs in the western side of the city, you know, you wouldn't have development right up against the swales and the, you know, vegetation and stuff like you have. It needs to be an understeer area, and then they'd be able to develop in a clustered format. But, you know, it's a little bit different on the waterfront where there's actually historically always been a connection between the land and the sea, and the land and the water.
Yeah, and like you said, with walkways like that, the any kind of access is going to be in a public interest,
mm-hmm.
as far as the way I see it. So, what else?
Yeah, I don't think it was our intent to make it, you know, absolute, no forgiveness. I mean, I would think the preferable way would be to handle this kind of thing under a waiver. But we might want to check the language of that to see, you know, because usually, you know, on the waiver conditions, the burden of proof is pretty tough.
And it is in this language.
Yeah, so, you know, if we could change that, somehow change that wording.
I think it's worth looking at it
more
in more depth with regard to these kinds of questions. And then think about whether or not we need to change the language before we get too far down the road and then get stuck. Yeah.
Did you have any other?
Nope, that was it on that. And if, you know, if people want to discuss it more, we can after at the end of the meeting. But we want to move on to next.
Yeah. The story of rezoning and discussing open space parcel. When I was at the last planning and development subcommittee meeting, I spoke a couple times, and at one time Barry Connell asked me if I was speaking for the commission or if I was speaking for myself, and since we hadn't had a vote here, I was speaking, told him I was speaking for myself. I basically like to know what everybody thinks of that situation, whether we want to weigh in or we should weigh in as a commission on what we'd like to see happen.
What was the nature of your comments at the meeting?
You have to ask me that. What was the nature of my comments? At least for that meeting, it was regarding cost and everything. They were offering $15,000, but that would only cover the cost of the endowment for Essex County Greenbelt. And any other work like the seeding that would have to go on out there would come out of our funds or city funds of some sort. Essex County might consider giving us a waiver on that amount and then take whatever's left over. They actually have had people go and seed a field in just this manner to make sure it didn't get overrun. But I guess in general, do we want to show support or not non-support?
Well,
or
apart from seeding and monitoring, what are the costs associated with making this a viable public access open space parcel? I mean, you mentioned boardwalks earlier on in some of the discussions we've had, which are very costly.
Yes.
If you're going to build a lot of boardwalks.
That really is, and we're talking, I don't remember the exact number, but it was several hundred feet of boardwalk just to go down to the back of the parcel. So, because it is all pretty much all wetland, according to this map that they put up there, it's the whole plowed field is a wet meadow, and it's wetlands on either side. So, do we want? I would think we'd want to have some sort of boardwalk through there to make sure we're not causing any serious erosion, and you know, it would give people a spot to bird watch or whatever they want to do out there.
So did that portion of the $15,000 cover all that boardwalk too?
No, it's the. I talked to David Santamena, and he told me that a normal endowment for Essex County Greenbelt is $15,000. So, I'm assuming that that's why they picked $15,000 for it. And he also said, like, for other properties like Olio, the person or the entity donating the property pays that $15,000. So,
but their stewardship endowments just go to monitoring the stewardship. They don't go to doing active things on properties.
Right. No, exactly.
That's where the rubber hits the road for us. I mean, we don't want the public to think that this is going to be a wonderful open space that they can enjoy in all kinds of ways. If it's going to be very costly to do that, and there's no money to make it happen.
Right.
Well, and the other thing to keep in mind is their perception of this is, and I don't necessarily think they're wrong about it, is that, you know, they're giving this land to the city. Of course, there's benefits on both sides for how this is happening, but they're giving this large 20 acres, let's say, to the city, and they weren't proposing to build, you know, public access and so forth through there. They're proposing to provide parking, you know, public access to that space, but not necessarily build boardwalks and things like that. You know, on a larger scale, certainly we'd like to have, but not necessarily. One of the things they've announced is what's within scale in their development. You know, they're proposing essentially two buildings, you know, unreasonable scale on Story Avenue, consistent with the rest of the build-out type there. So, you know, we just want to make sure we're not asking for things that are disproportionate to what they can feasibly do within the project. Because you have to keep in mind that there's a lot that doesn't really come in from the commission, but is already on the table from these developers and things they've sort of committed to.
But my point is without the resources to make this into something valuable, it's not a bargaining chip from the developer's standpoint. There's a reason why this back when it hasn't been developed.
Well, and that's, but keep in mind that the land could also be incorporated with something else now or in the future. So, while you might perceive that land as being inaccessible from the front of a wooden property, there's a garage that could happen there, but it also may be more accessible from other angles. So, it still benefits the
city. But if you're going to fill the wetlands, well, how are you going to
well,
you do it?
I would submit to you that there are ways for them to get to that upland, even though it's in the back of the property.
The city already owns several much larger parcels that they haven't done anything with. There's the wet meadows, there's Cooper North. So it's not unreasonable to accept this and not do anything with it for a while until you have the money to do something with it. Also, if you take a look back a number of years ago at the Strategic Land Use Committee report, this was one of the parcels that was wanted to keep as open space so you would have this ecosystem between Hale Street and Low Street. So you'd have a contiguous number of parcels that are undeveloped. So we have a good start on that. It was, if we don't have the adjoining Oleo property, I don't know what's going on with the former Rockledge Realty Trust that Jerry might have in that property. But basically, the only piece of property that the city doesn't control out there is the Colby property, which abuts this piece of property. I think Jerry Mayette might have a right of first refusal on that one. But it would be progress towards that ecosystem. Whether we put trails out there this year or 5 years from now, in my mind, doesn't matter. You can still go out there and walk. It's public property. And there are, if you have a good eye, faint trails out there that you can follow that don't go in the wetlands.
The other thing I think is worth considering along that same vein is it's not necessarily a bargaining chip for them in the sense that they can basically, with the land that they have available through this agreement with the movement, they could build a CDS up there by the street without really needing the zoning change, for instance. So it's not as if they're using the open space as a complete leverage to get the zoning change. They could actually build something now. And I'm not necessarily, I think that the type of build-out, the type of building that they want to do there in the development is pretty consistent with what is expected on Story Avenue. Surely the architecture, you know, can be better than what's there right now in some places, but they are proposing something I think is relatively decent, and it's not necessarily that they're using the open space to leverage that. There's actually reasons for zoning and planning where we want zone after that, and never mind the open space at the back. So I just think it's important that we keep in mind how much we're asking them to do for what's, relatively speaking, a very small zoning map change.
And do you think that it would be useful for the commission to weigh in on this? Do you think it would be useful for the commission to, say, vote and to be in support of acquiring that 20 acres of open space?
Yeah, I mean, I think that similar to Mary Harbaugh, I spoke at the meeting as well, and I was there for most of the discussion with the council on the zone change. I think, you know, clearly you don't necessarily, wouldn't necessarily be taking a stance on the development side of it, sort of up towards Story Avenue, that smaller piece of it, but certainly it would be beneficial, I think, to say, you know, as we in the planning office have said, as some of the councils have said, you know, the open space committee said, we want to make sure that land is kept as open space. It doesn't necessarily mean that you're pro, you know, development Story Avenue side, but if whatever mechanism results in the preservation of that is open space, that would be a good thing.
I just think it's hard to avoid that characterization. I think that open space is a pretty small tail is potentially going to wag a bigger dog. I think the development stands or falls on what the Story app part of it is like, and I agree, which is what you just said a minute ago. And so I just don't think we want to be put in the position to say we're in favor of the rezoning because the open space is such a great idea. Because I don't.
I don't think the commission would have to say that they're in favor of the rezoning. I think you could just say that should the rezoning take place, the commission would gladly accept the open space.
Yeah, I think that's
fine. You know,
fair.
And that it's something
that
we consider to be a valuable piece of the greater open space plan for the city, something like that.
Right, yeah.
But that's assuming that the development plan per se and Story Avenue is viable and is supportable by those who need to support it.
Yes, ma'am. Helen.
I think it would be good to put on record what Julia has stated because we have another potential development that is just.
indeed. So, yeah, you know, it would be great to have it, but it doesn't mean that we have to right now start spending a lot of money to make it even more accessible, like with trails and stuff. When we have money, we have money. But just to have it, I think it's
as long as we can do it without taking a position one way or the other on merits of the other issues connected with the frontage.
It gets very complicated,
yeah.
No, I understand.
Because those really aren't our issues.
No. So our statement would be open space is good?
Exactly.
This
particular open space is valuable to the city because I think it would be helpful to have a record.
Yeah.
If you can do that, I would appreciate that. So I have to steal him for a second.
So, would you mind drafting something?
I'll draft something, yeah.
Okay. And we can vote on it next meeting since it looks like they're... Are they going to delay the vote?
I don't know.
It sounded like they were going to. They were trying to.
Yeah.
The
meeting on Thursday is it to discuss the rezoning? I guess I'm confused.
Is it to finish the discussion?
Well, that's in committee. That's...
They voted on it.
Well, Anne is saying there's two meetings Thursday. I don't know what the first one is.
Yeah, I don't know what the first one is.
Well,
do you want to vote? You could vote on it now, sort of in concept, and I'll draft the appropriate language.
I'll make a motion that we send a letter to the planning subcommittee, stating that we... believe that acquisition of this property is open space to be a valuable asset to the community, and that Julie will write such a letter signed by Joe to go to the subcommittee.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
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 Opposed? Okay. Well, this is a good time, being 7 o'clock and all, to go to our regular agenda. So the first item is the Springwell Investment Conservation Restriction, the vote on certification. That would be the Oleo Conservation Restriction. But we got something from... I and Doug, who's been looking at it for us, regarding issues that the Springwell lawyer had with the language in that. Doug, could you give us a...
Yeah, sort of the 11th hour that the Springwell's counsel came back with a reiteration of points he made back in August that hadn't been adopted in the subsequent drafts. Wants to revisit them, some of which are fairly substantive. They go more to the relationship between the landowner and the holder of the restriction rather than Springwell as a developer, but some of it is pretty substantive, and there are a couple of issues that are probably going to have to go back to the state for reconsideration. So, long story short, there's more work to do on the conservation restriction. Because really, it's not in a position to be voted.
Okay.
There is one thing I wanted to raise, though. Clearly, what's going on here is that Springwell wants to get rid of the CR property as quickly as possible. I think, from the city's point of view, the city ought not to be taking title to that unless they get an estoppel from Greenbelt, basically saying that there's no violations of the restriction at this point. Because I don't think we are going to want to do a lot of ongoing monitoring out there. I'm not sure how much Greenbelt is planning to do during the development phase, the Springwell development. So I think it's important when the city takes title to it that we get a clean certificate from Greenbelt saying CR has not been violated.
Okay. Thank you. Can I get a motion?
Motion to recess for public hearings.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? All right. First item. Commonwealth of Massachusetts. Mass Highway Department. Whittier Bridge Project. Nice and strong.
Yeah. You all set up?
Mm-hmm.
Mayor stepped
up. Oh, sorry. Oh. I'll look this way. For a couple of minutes. Okay.
Good
Good evening. I'm Mike Berlin, the Parsons Breaker Hub, from the consultant for MassDOT on the Whittier Bridge project. Last time we were here, there were a couple of issues outstanding. The commission wanted a presentation of the construction staging. We're still working on our riverfront plan, which we have to discuss tonight. And we are prepared, if there are still any questions associated with drainage, to address those also. I have a series of plans here. They may be a little difficult. I'll just orientate you because they're repetitive. This shows you our vision and actually tied to the overall schedule and how it is built. The contractor's plan is going to have to be very similar to this, maybe some subtle change, but it's very similar to this in order to meet the objective of getting the project completed in the 3.5-year period that it needs to be. On the plans, you'll see top and bottom. This starting at all the plans are orientated to the north. So this is exit 57, this is the parking ride. Rolling through this point is Pine Hill, bridge going over. You come up to the shore of the river, going across, and this goes into Amesbury. And then the next sheet actually is the rest of the sequence in terms of phase one. I have five phases I'm going to show you. And actually, the last phase is basically project culmination in terms of finishing up. And I've labeled up top in terms of when the approximately the time frame that we're in at this point in time. Now, where we are in terms of moving forward with permits in process is that we expect to, in April, starting the procurement process, what's known as a letter of interest to qualified design build entities. There'll be a they'll indicate their interest. A statement of requested to send in a statement of qualifications that will get reviewed by the department. That process will be in the May-June timeframe. The teams will come in, and of the teams responding, anywhere from 3 to 5 teams will be selected to proceed to the technical phase of the project, when they'll be invited to review the technical documents and then provide a bid. The technical phase will kick off in August. By then, we should have all permits on the project. The last one being, in terms of the sequence that we run through, would be the Coast Guard permit. We expect that at the very end of July, and that would start off our ability to provide the technical package to the teams. The technical package includes the 25% design. It includes all of the permits associated with it, the conditions and general conditions. The teams will get the application early August, level 2.5 months. To basically review it and provide a bid based upon their with their designer to complete the job and provide a bid to do so. That'll be evaluated in the October-November time frame, and the state will use what's known as a best value determination, which takes points for the technical submission which they make, and then they get scored, and then they'll actually open the bids during a separate envelope publicly. And then they'll create the best value, which is an equation of the technical scores in terms of how they impact the bid value of the job. And that ends up being the best value. They'll be the parent low bidder. With that sequence, they're looking to award at the very end of December of 2013, which issue in a notice to proceed, which gets us to where we are here. Typically, it takes a contractor a couple of months to get all this paperwork in. It's early submissions, early design work to support it. And in spring of 2013, you'll see the contractor beginning to mobilize. The critical path in terms of how this project needs to be built and what's taking the most time is the bridge work. And what we've determined by building the new bridge east of the new northbound bridge east of the existing bridge, it allows it to be built. The traffic stays on the existing bridge. It's built off the side. And that new northbound bridge is actually wide enough to take the existing traffic the way it exists today, northbound and southbound, going over onto the new bridge, allows a single-phase demolition of that bridge when all the traffic's on the new bridge, and then a construction of the new southbound bridge to its full width that's required with the breakdown lane, shoulder, and 4 lanes of traffic at the end of the job. Southbound goes over. And then you've just got northbound in its interim condition on the new northbound bridge. The barrier will be removed. That 3 lanes of traffic will be moved over so they can actually reconstruct the new barrier at the edge of the breakdown lane, which ends up delineating the shared use path. At that point in time, they can actually then open up the 4th lane of northbound And then the shared use path was exactly the last element of the project that goes into use, because a portion of it helps support the construction of this job. So in the spring of 2013, exit 57, park and ride, and I've colored all the basins up in blue, just so you can see in terms of where the basins are being constructed. There, some of the early work that can be taking place, although it's not driving, is the shared use path. But once you get up here, we actually need to do some road work underneath the Pine Hill Bridge. Also, one of the first things that takes place is there are temporary utilities which actually run in the alignment power lines where Old Ferry Road used to go. And we have to, on an interim basis, move those lines adjacent to the existing bridge so those can be removed. The lines are at the extent of how long you can have between poles, and one of those poles is right in the way of the widening portion of the highway as we build on the inside curve to line ourselves up with that new northbound bridge. So the first aspects that will take place in the spring, besides mobilizing the river to set up the cofferdams to build the three piers in the water, will be there'll be tree removal and grubbing, clearing, and work associated with where the new highway is going to shift. There'll also be on water department land building the new basin. One of the other issues under the existing bridge, adjacent to the existing bridge with the three lanes, I know you can't see it, but there's three Howards going north, three south, right down here on the shore, is that the existing outfall, the 36-inch, is right here next to the adjacent bridge. Well, we need to build the new abutment structure, and one of the first things that's going to happen is that the contractor will build this new permanent outfall location, in a stub pipe out, and they'll have to start from a series of interim connections to that, and so the existing outfall will go out of service sometime in the summer of 2013. And how the water gets there over the next 18 months will change in the upland area as they're building and moving pipes back and forth, but its outfall location will be the new 42-inch outfall location. That work continues into Amesbury in terms of, as the highway has moved to the east, building all of the new roadway work as well as the bridge in Amesbury over Evans Place adjacent to the other. In the meantime, I'm not going to get into the details. We're widening the bridges in the interchange at Amesbury-Salisbury as well as the bridges for the railroad tracks, and we'll set up the widening work to begin widening in the median between exit 58 and exit 60. This is just the rest of the work in the sequence. We're what I call stage two. It's the summer 2013 through 2014. These are the activities that are going to take place, and they're all driven by activities to build the new bridge, the new northbound bridge. By the summer, a portion of that widening will actually be put in service, and this is so that we can actually move traffic over once we've demolished half of the width of the existing bridge at Pine Hill. We will set up traffic lights on either end and operate that bridge one way on opposing directions. That's to keep the new bridge on as close to the location that the existing bridge is. That'll allow us to build the new abutment structure, which is now further to the east. The western abutment is roughly the same location, but the center pier is in a different location because the highway is shifting. So we need to actually move traffic over a little bit and change the curvature coming into the existing bridge, although it's still going on the existing bridge at this point, which is a sliver of that new work. And that's associated with our ability to build the new bridge at Pine Hill. Besides having earlier set up the cofferdams, the sequence of 1, 2, 3 across, we'll be working on those piers in the water at that point in time. The contractor will be having all of the bridge steel fabricated off-site. There'll be barges and equipment in the river. They'll be moored in the areas between the two channels, as for the Coast Guard permits that we've worked out. They'll continue to build the abutment structures of the new bridge. They'll be building the retaining walls of the new bridge, and construction of the bridge at Evans will continue. Retaining wall continues to run up along this area where the road has shifted to the east as it winds back up with the interchange in Amesbury. And that's the work condition and sequence that really will take you from the summer of 2013 to the summer of 2014. In in the summer of 2014, will be the first shift in traffic. That traffic will shift over for the northbound traffic to be lining up for the, not in the summer of 2014. that comes later. We continue to build out the new roadway elements. We get all the traffic onto the new bridge. It takes two sequences through that time to get onto the new bridge. At which time we get out here and start working on the other areas where the bridge had been, preparing for demolition. And right after all traffic northbound, southbound has been shifted onto the traffic in that summer, we work on demolition of the existing bridge. That demolition will take about 6 months in total to get the piers out. Some of the construction of the new bridge will overlap with that demolition phase, but all of the work will be centered in this area. We'll also be working on the approaches because the roadway profile changes a little bit. It actually comes up about 4 foot on the Newburyport side and about 5 foot on the Amesbury side. The new bridge is a little bit higher than the existing bridge. We still need to maintain the clearance of 56 foot in the main channel, which is underneath the arch. The other work will be continuing up in Amesbury and beyond. Most of that work will probably be completed within the first 2 years. It doesn't actually see traffic until later in the sequence, but most likely we build the contractor will get that out of his way. The other basins will be constructed at the same time, but those are actually in Amesbury. So once the bridge is demolished, and through the spring of 2015 to the summer of 2016, all the work will be associated with building the new South Farm Bridge and tying in and lining it up with the highway elements. The actual highway edge line on the west side of the existing southbound doesn't change at all because all of the widening, of course, is going to the east. So even the extra lane is to the east of the existing configuration that is out there today. The traffic sometime in the late spring will be able to, as I said before, the new southbound bridge will be complete. It will go from a three-lane configuration to shift over for the first time. You'll have four lanes in this corridor heading southbound. At that point in time, you've got an empty southbound on the existing bridge, and you've got three lanes of traffic on the new bridge, I just called existing. And there's a barrier. That barrier will be removed. The traffic will be moved over. Still three lanes, at which time the contractor will reconstruct a new barrier, which will delineate the edge of the breakdown lane from the shared use path. When that work is completed, then the final phase of northbound will be opened up to four lanes, in which time the shared use path will be open. The work in terms of getting southbound over to the shared use path and the northbound being reconfigured will take about two to 3 months, and that'll take it to around midsummer of 2016. At which time the project will be completed and we'll be doing what we call punch listing and final acceptance by the state. That's the overall summary in terms of what the impacts are. As you can see, from Newburyport standpoint, all of the real work in terms of new impacts to land and drainage and features such as the basin, all of that work kicks off in the spring of 2013. And most of that work from an impact standpoint is actually completed by the end of 2013 as the roadway goes in service in 2014. Any questions in terms of the sequence or the areas that we'll be working in?
Well, I'm just curious. You mentioned the barges that will be in there to support the construction. Mm-hmm. How much movement are those? Or are those barges going to be going up and down river a lot? Or are they just going to be...
The barges, some of the barges will be fairly stationary. They'll be creating workspace.
Right.
Wherever there's a pier location and they've created the coffer dam structure, there'll be a work barge basically stationary tied up there. And basically it's their work area above the work zone below. They'll have equipment, pumps. That's what they'll see. When the reinforcing steel will be brought there and tied and created in the form elements, there'll be a service crane on there supporting it. And pretty much the sequence will be is that they'll most likely run from peer to peer to peer. What's interesting between the three peers is that peer number one is founded on bedrock, like the existing peer one. If you remember, there are four piers to the current bridge. There'll be three with the new bridge. Peer two, the new peer two, is basically straddles the location between peer two and peer three today. But the water is deep where Pier 1 is, and it's about 18 to 20 foot of water. It's a scoured bottom. It's all bedrock. The topography and the strata in this area, geology in this area, you've got the islands. It's creating this ridge running down the river, and the rock comes up. And it's actually at extreme low. There's a small rock outcropping apparently under our new Pier 2 location. It's a deep cofferdam here, but it's a relatively shallow cofferdam that gets constructed here. What's also unique is as the rock undulates and basically gets steep and comes up and goes back down, right here, where Pier 3 is, there's a fold. So in this area, there's actually a fold and this gravel fill in that area. So where this one is founded on bedrock, this is founded on the bedrock outcropping, this one actually they'll drive. Most likely traditional H piles, about 35 foot long, and then within the box, then they'll place a concrete underwater called Tremi. Then they'll dewater it, then they'll build a pier like they would in the other locations in the dry as they come up. But the work efforts will pretty much follow the sequence in terms of how the cofferdams get built. They're being built one at a time, and then right as this crew goes from here, a secondary crew will come over and they'll be working inside. They'll do their work and they'll follow the crews across. Those will be moving around. There'll be materials coming in. They will have to find a location where they can load their reinforcing steel from an appropriate industrial work site onto their barges and work skiffs. They'll be moving up and down the river.
Yeah.
Later on, the bridge steel comes in, and that steel will most likely come in from the Atlantic. Up the river. We can't think of any places where the members that size are coming in upriver. We're not aware of that. The contractor may find one, but we're not aware of that.
So the barges will be coming upriver?
Yeah, there'll be barge activity and basically pusher work boats coming in and out. All the steel for the new bridges will be coming in that way. You know, the concrete. They'll come up and they'll construction access points along the right of way. They'll drive down the right of way with the concrete. There'll probably be a concrete pumper truck. Will actually lift it and it'll probably be transferred to a work barge here to another concrete pumper truck to get the concrete into the pier locations as they build the stems and piers up out of the water. Most of the work will. The steel will come into the river, and the concrete and other supplies will basically come from the two ends of the bridge.
Now, can I assume you're talking with the Harbor Commission as to the barge traffic?
They have to coordinate with the Coast Guard, and they have to make sure that they keep the channels clear. There will be a few times for certain operations when one channel or the other will be closed for lifting the bridge steel, or when they place the network arch. There'll probably be like a two-day closure for that operation because it'll get built between the two channels, the Army Corps channel and the local steamboat channel, and then it'll be jacked up high enough, positioned, brought in, and on an outgoing tide to be lowered in on top of the bearings. They'll release it from the barge, and the barge will pull out of the lake.
The portion of the bridge going from the embankment out to Pier 1,
mm-hmm.
will that be constructed by barge from the water side, or
it'll be a combination of both. As we've permitted, there may or may not be a temporary pier location to deal with the long splice of the steel. So some of that steel will be loaded from cranes topside, as well as there'll be barges positioning steel from out in the river itself. But it'll work in both locations. A lot of it gets into the specific design build contractor in terms of what equipment he has, whether he likes to go with very large lifts or whether he wants to keep things a little bit smaller. It gets into their own sophistication and then how they work with their designers for a lot of these things in terms of how they get built, what's called means and methods. Any other questions?
The duration of this project, you said a lot of the land work on be done probably within the first year.
Yes.
Are you anticipating a series of partial certificates for the project?
Certificates for
compliance.
I don't think so, because even though we're getting the new bridge built, we're going to have to demolish the existing bridge, and that's going to be causing disturbance in the riverfront area. And then we have to build the new abutments before all of that's done. That actually segues into a presentation we wanted to give on the riverfront build out. Any other questions? Okay, great. I guess I'm not sure. Tim or Sarah, when are you going to talk to the riverfront?
Some minor revisions we made to riverfront impacts relating to changes just shifting around to accommodate the new outfall location, which Mike, as Mike said, we've shifted slightly to the west to avoid wetland impacts. We've modified the Hilly Road and the on the east side of the northbound abutment to extend it further for basically for you folks to be able to develop land quicker and adapted some our riverfront restoration and impacts to that. Excuse me. And we also modified a table that's in the NOI, which is attached to the front of that sheet, to adjust for those impacts. And if you look, you'll see that the total impact area changed by less than 1,000 square feet. So it was really focused. Added up, it was a relatively minor change. Excuse me. Any questions on either the impacts that we proposed or related to riverfront impacts, which kind of leads right into the riverfront restoration, which was our main topic the last time we met. This larger plan shows what we're proposing for riverfront restoration, and on just for orientation, this is north over here, so this new northbound lane is coming this way. This is the existing abutment coming this way. Merrimack River's over here. This is the riverfront zone, the 200-foot riverfront zone. The new abutments will end here, and the new proposed outfall is shown in this location here, almost directly under the existing road now. It's old location. You can kind of best see on this figure by the scour patch that it's left from into the 100-year floodplain. So its old location was here. In the first year, they're going to shift flow over to the new outfall, and that'll be functional at that time. For restoring the riverfront area, we have developed zones for planting and restoration. The primary treatment of the substrate will be to develop a small riprap base kind of along these steeper slopes and overlay 6 inches, give or take, of a compost material as a planting substrate. Once that's established, the idea is to come in and plant according to zones that have a variety of moisture and sunlight availability. And the simplest way to think about this is that a darker green is essentially full sunlight and full exposure to precipitation. the lightest blue color is directly under the two bridges, and that's related to minimum moisture and minimum sunlight, because it'll be underneath the deck, so it just won't be getting the sunlight and the moisture. And then in between, we have zones that reflect an intermediate condition. And for instance, in between the abutments, we'll have a little bit less sunlight, a little bit less moisture. And these shade zones kind of direct just under, we've actually established a 15-foot width of planting zone kind of right under the shadow of, or the edge of the bridge. And part of that was based off the shading analysis that we did, and part of it was based off of an estimate of where we thought the splash zone of rain would be. So these areas will get moderate sun and moderate moisture. And our thought was that the outer sections of the bridge will get more moisture than the two inner ones, just because this gap will provide a little bit less slant for moisture to get blown in. So that said, we have this complex array of planting zones, but they all are following what we best estimate to be different moisture and sunlight regimes. And once we established those, we went through the literature, and DOT Landscaping has a lot of experience in roadside plantings. They've developed a planting list that we will distribute to you shortly that has a list of species that would be reasonable for each zone. So the contractor will be able to go through and, based on the availability of some of these species and the timing of the planting, they will be able to select a variety of species that will accommodate the plantings along the bridge. One other thing about the plantings is that we are looking at taller plantings, sort of out in the open, and obviously shorter plantings in the areas under the bridge for maintenance reasons. And also for in these areas directly under the bridge, we will do a combination of just plain conservation mix seeding with a drought-tolerant seed species and a few plantings, because it is difficult to find plantings that you can establish directly under the bridge, especially as you get kind of closer up the slope. So that's about it. Just so you're clear, this planting zone matches the footprint of the riverfront area impacts. So this is how we're planning on restoring the riverfront zone in the work area of the bridge. Questions?
Sarah, if I just may add something from MassDOT. Julia, in the package that we submitted, I believe at the end of last week, it included that package near the end of the package was this figure, and also the planting list.
Yep, that's right. Yep. That's right. You've already received the planting
list.
Yes,
we did. Thank you. Without all that. Yeah.
I debated bringing it for you. I figured you did not want to look at a table like that. The other piece that we needed to wrap up with wetlands issues is salt marsh concern directly under the new bridge. The riverfront zone is up here. The orientation is the same. This is the new northbound bridge. This is the existing bridge, which will soon be the new southbound bridge. Merrimack River is here. The two existing salt marsh patches are right here, and then this is the small one that's directly under the easternmost corner of the existing bridge. The discussion has been to attempt to enhance the salt marsh, or the former salt marsh area that's been scoured out by the existing outfall. We had originally proposed a boulder silt to capture material coming, sediments coming down the river, and kind of jumpstart colonization by salt marsh. We've been asked to go a step further, so we have. But in the course of that, we've decided that the boulder sill is probably not the best way to take that next step. So what we're proposing now is a coir log, one of those big coconut fiber logs that that will be approximately 12 inches in diameter across the front edge of this gap, behind which we'll backfill with a sand mix of coarse to medium and fine sands. And in that material, over the sand mix itself, we'll also put a jute mat to hold the material in place, and then plant salt cordgrass, the Lomer spartina alterniflora, in this zone. And we'll be able to do that in year one of the project, because this outfall is going to be diverted over here, which will eliminate the scour, the original problem here. So we'll be able to get this going in the first year, and we have up to 3 years of monitoring to make sure it establishes and do any replacement plantings as we need. Also included in the package that we received is this detail. If you look on it, you'll see that here's a quick profile showing the existing substrates here. We'll anchor the square log in the front, backfill behind it with find the mixed sands, and then plant the cordgrass directly into the mixed sands.
In the narrative that we're seeing, it says that the monitoring will only be for 1 year. And I prefer to be for
and
to
we
will
be able to do that.
And for that core log, core of the coconut fiber thing, be filled with sand? Or
no, not initially. When it's initially placed, it's literally just sort of a matrix of coconut fiber. But these core logs are used routinely in summer situations like this. And what they do is, first of all, the alterniflora will grow directly into it and establish the biomass from the roots. But it will also capture any sediment that may filter out of this sand, and most more particularly will be coming down the river and just settling out. So by the end, these are designed to be, they're naturally biodegradable, organic material. By the end, ideally, this log will essentially become a fabric of the peat. So by the time it's deteriorating, the peat will be established and we'll replace it in terms of its stabilizing measure.
And this is completely under the new rock ground, is that correct?
It will be, yes.
So there will be, in my favorite issue, shade.
There will be shade.
I think we don't agree on the effects of that shade to this point. I would contend that that's probably not going to grow because of the shade, but the proof will be in the pudding.
It will.
If it doesn't grow, what's plan B?
Well, I think the intention of this is to attempt to jumpstart this location here. We're not proposing this as mitigation for anything. We're not expecting additional salt marsh impacts. This is a measure to do our best to enhance it. If it doesn't work, we will have 3 years to mess with it to try to make it work. If that fails, then which it won't fail. It won't fully fail. It may not establish in what you're envisioning as a full sunlight marsh, but there will be plants here, and they will be functional.
Okay. And in that statement, we also have existing salt marsh, which is now going to be completely under the bridge.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't know what's going to happen to that. I mean, you're proposing that there will be moderate impacts. So I don't know exactly what that means. But if there are, the salt marsh thins or completely goes away, what's the point? Because that would require mitigation.
Well, I think this whole process has been to demonstrate that that's not going to happen. If we thought that that was going to happen, you're correct that we would be required to mitigate it. We've spent huge amount of time with the Army Corps of Engineers, with DEP regional experts, trying to work through this process so they understood what we were doing, and to guarantee that that wouldn't happen, because as you know, if we thought that that was going to be the case, we would be required to mitigate for it.
I think in terms of the word moderate, I heard you mention it that sort of going to moderately impact. I don't think we've determined from a shading standpoint that it was going to create a moderate impact. Basically, the terminology we had in terms of the moderate and severe is just tied to the amount of shading we have, not as to whether that's creating an impact.
Well, to some degree, yes, and to some degree, there is an impact. There's no doubt about it. The shade over any plant species, and you'll see a change. But what we've seen on the other side, which is our best example of how we think this site might behave, if you go over there, you will see salt marsh species. You'll see Spartina alterniflora directly under the bridge. You'll see Spartina patens there. There's cattail. It's a different structure. It's a different density, but it is there, and it's fully functional.
Quick question. Because in the document that we have, it specifies a one-year monitoring plan, could we get a little bit more detail about the three-year monitoring plan? In other words, what is that going to involve? Is it going to be monitoring for just this salt marsh area? Is it going to be monitoring for the entire landscaped area underneath the bridges? And what are the, responses to potential results of that monitoring?
Sure. Anyone want to speak directly to the environmental monitoring?
I think in terms of the monitoring, we indicated here that because we haven't been having an environmental monitor on the project over the duration, here was an opportunity to be 3 years worth of monitoring. And typically, all the project is required to do is 1 year, which is why it says 1 year, but here there's an opportunity to do 3 years. Some of the last plantings under the final bridge that's built, that plant season won't happen until spring of 2016. Mm-hmm. And so at that point in time, I think what the project / the contractor will be held to is the traditional landscaping materials 1 year warranty in terms of for replacement.
I'm thinking.
Anything else except for that explanation, Tim or Jim or whoever, please.
Yeah, I think the biggest thing is you need to separate the riverfront area planting plan. That is required mitigation from riverfront area impact. So we are required to do the one-year monitoring to replace, you can add anything to that, but replace anything that isn't taken during that period. But with regard to the salt marsh, that's basically just an enhancement that we're doing to benefit project that we saw it, we could do something simple as and potentially jumpstart salt marsh coming back to the area after we remove that alcohol location. And that's not a required mitigation for this project, it's just sort of a thrown enhancement that we thought would benefit the project. So they are different in that regard.
And in regards to the riverfront area mitigation, we haven't sequenced out specifically how they're going to plant which area when, but it just makes sense when they're done to the northbound bridge, stabilize the slope, plant, do your seeding over the compost, then do your planting, move over to the next bridge. Mm-hmm. So that's how I anticipate we'll do it, and we can, I don't think it would be an issue to write out a contract to require that. The only hinging point there would be whether the design build contractor still wants access from the east. So that road that's being constructed, he may, as part of a staging plan, bring in equipment or materials or manpower from the east. So you may still have some slopes that may be disturbed. So it's going to be a matter of how he works with his landscape designer to sequence it all out. But certainly when the northbound bridge is completed, it'll be compost and seeded. Whether they put in the shrub and tree plantings at that time, or just wait to do it when they finish the work on the southbound bridge, I don't know.
Yeah, I guess my question and concern was more related to the plant, because there's so many different planting zones related to the variations in light and moisture and et cetera under the bridge, and it's kind of a complicated planting program. To monitor that for just 1 year, I mean, then you could replace what didn't grow, but maybe you need to tweak it at that point. Maybe something didn't last because it was not getting enough moisture there, and just by replacing those few plants, it's just the same thing's going to happen again. So I guess I'm looking for a little bit more detail on how you would address any problems that would come up through monitoring. You know.
No matter when, you know, no matter
right.
what the sequence is.
Right.
Yes.
I know it's hard to say now because the sequence plan is going to change in the course of the design, but...
Yeah, I'm just trying to think how we can work that out from the contract. In regards to the planting scheme, you know, we're fairly conservative. Let's throw plants in there that can tolerate shade, that can tolerate drought and on this gradient, with the assumption that we're going with the strongest plants for that particular regime, anticipating that if conditions are suitable for other species, that will also colonize and come in. I think what we could do is include a note on the planting plan that, or within the planting species list, that basically through the course of the monitoring, the environmental monitor uses their best judgment. If certain plant species seem to be failing, they choose other plant species that they think may be more appropriate or may function given the condition of the particular zone that they're in.
Right. I mean, maybe we could have a condition, something to the effect of a report on after the 1 year monitoring period, a report on what has survived and what hasn't, and you know why certain replantings are appropriate in that area. Just to give us a little bit more information than
because not only are we going to have a sequential planting plan going on, possibly we're going to have seasons. And if we just look at the difference between this season and last season as far as winter goes, it would be under a lot more harsh conditions if it was like last winter. And you know, we want to ensure that the life of any plants that go in whatever the timing is is.
So we can come up with a special condition.
It's not
going to
be easy
to write, but it's
important to note that the there are performance standards tied to the plantings. The contractor's not going to get paid in full when he puts it in. He's going to get paid 30% when he puts it in, and 30% when he's done with that phase, and another, you know, the final chunk a year later, when we've made the determination that all the plants are healthy. So we're not just paying them to install them. We're paying them to install them with success.
So our language with our conditions has to be in concert with the language that goes into...
Well, I should hope that it's similar, and then we'd be happy to help you write it.
Yeah. That would
make it, you know, very, very clear that we don't just pay a contractor to spray down seed mix.
Yeah.
We pay them to spray down seed mix with success.
I'll consult our landscape section as well, just to see if the current way that we have the landscape warranty, you know, if I plant a high bush blueberry and that high bush blueberry died in the first year, you know, as the contractor, I'm required to replace it. So I'll just check and see with them if it works under that same framework. If we see all of one particular shrub species die in the planting zone, probably doesn't make sense to plant that shrub species there again under that warranty and just change the species to something that's a little bit more tolerant given that condition of that planting zone. So I'll check in with them in that regard.
Okay.
Good question. On the enhancement for the salt marsh area, you said that you thought that would be done next year, 2013. And I was just wondering, you know, if it gets towards late 2013 before you can do that, is there any reason, or would it be better that work would then defer it until the spring? Once winter comes, if it's a more normal winter, there's a lot
Well, that would make sense. The construction sequencing is going to be what drives that. And as soon as the outfall is relocated, which will be one of the earliest steps of the process, because that's
steps.
Going to affect access underneath the bridge.
Right, but you know, things happen.
Yep.
But I guess in terms of the planting, in terms of all the species to go there, I guess at the same time we could give them a table. There's a window of opportunity to get those in between sometime in the spring to sometime in the summer or fall.
Yeah.
And if it goes outside that window, then they're best to wait for the next season. We know that the outfall will get relocated the first season, but if it happens later and it falls outside that window, it could.
Right, yeah, it's kind of like a lot of wasted expense.
Right, that's a good point.
But if that were to occur, then we wouldn't have a 3-year monitoring. It happened in early 2020.
Well, it depends whether you want to monitor something that you if you're fairly confident it's going to survive the first winter, forcibly established. But, I mean, that's okay. But, it may be
so
more cost justified to.
It would just have a sunset provision on the monitoring that if the planting was delayed until 2014, then it would only be 2.5 years of monitoring.
What's the end of the window? I don't think it's exactly.
For cordgrass?
Yeah.
It's usually, I wouldn't want to see it going much past probably the end of September,
okay.
Maybe early October in Amesbury, the report.
Just in terms of how this has to go, I can't envision where the outfall would be relocated later than that. The first thing they're going to want to do is they're going to jump off the river and start the property, because that's the driving point of the schedule. But right behind that is some of the shore work, such as the relocation of the outfall. They're going to build a new outfall, and they're going to basically work the first temporary iteration of it to remove that structure that's there. I'm real confident that in terms of any scenario that we've looked at, that would be accomplished by the end of September.
That's fine. Just leave that statement as it is, and if something happens and you decide that it'd be better to confer it, you can just send us a letter saying, hey,
your point's well taken. We can put some language in that gives a planting window and has monitoring through the end of the project or something like that.
So the assumption is that the pier construction, the cofferdams, and the deck that's going to go above, the northbound deck, is not going to impact too badly on the enhancement, which will already have gone in?
Correct.
Is that
correct? The resources underneath the bridges are very clearly spelled out and are to be avoided.
That's it. I was wondering about that. What about the delivery of the cement that's coming?
I can't tell you how it will be delivered.
They will be built, most likely, as they build the abutment structures up, they build up those walls, which are 50 foot back. Many of you have probably seen the construction sites, these trucks with these large pipe arms, and they're concrete pumper trucks. And most likely what will happen is that there will be concrete delivered there by a pumper truck, and they can get up to 300 foot long reach with these pieces of equipment as they're articulated. They can actually potentially, with a single one, get up to the first pier location. The mid pier, they're going to have to basically set up a transfer barge, and they would take it from, basically pump it from one truck into the receiving pump of the other truck, and then just pick it up and pump again.
So
it's likely to be two.
Yeah, so
but they're not going to be down on the shore with concrete trucks or anything like that. It's all going to be on the upper
yeah.
there.
Okay.
And anything they really do down there is going to be really working from the upland, especially as they build up the new walls. They'll be building them up as they go, but it won't be all over the shore area because we can't live in the shore area in terms of the impacts. The only thing that we'll be doing there is dealing with some of the restoration and then the rock and the relocation of the permitted outfall and removal of the existing outfall.
I think it's Joe Pavel, MassDOT. I just think it's important to note that we're discussing means and methods and one of the advantages to the department of design build and expediting this project is means and methods and leaving that up to the design build entity. So Mike's talking about from his experience what he thinks is going to happen. It's probably going to be pretty close, but I want everybody to keep in mind if you have three different design build entities here, there's going to be three different ways to build this bridge. So we can only speculate as to what we think is going to happen. whoever gets selected is going to need to demonstrate to us for approval their work plan, how they're going to proceed with this work, how they're going to stage it, how they're going to access the waterfront, where they're going to place the barges. We try to permit this with right-of-way and temporary easements to allow them to build a bridge, and we give them environmental permitting that will allow them to construct the project that would be designed. If they come to us with something totally different that requires them to work outside of the permits that we put in place for them, they're going to need to submit that. They're going to need to come back here before you and obtain approvals from us and from the contractors. So we're taking our best guess at it. I just want to caution everyone that as we talk about this, be something totally different. Right. They want to fly in by helicopter and they can do it, so be it.
And really the worst case is that, you know, somebody does something a different way after you planted that the salt marsh, and they break it.
The bottom line is the first thing they need to do is send us they have to give us a construction sequence with all the durations, where they're going to be, when they're going to be there, what they're going to be doing, what they're going to be impacting. That's the first thing that has to come in before they start work for a project.
I just wanted to add that because they only have 3.5 years basically to build this project, they don't have any time to get their permits. So
they're going to want to work within what we have.
We're looking for the permits.
We don't anticipate that.
No.
This is not time because on September 30th of 2016, the money ends. So they need to be out of it because right now there's been no funding source identified. So if they want to go into a 6-month permitting change, it would be nothing.
Yeah. And as they submit, as we go through the procurement process, the design build, we have a selection committee that's set up. We shortlist three or four teams. They will submit to us technical proposals, which would be based on the base technical concept that PB's put together. So they have to work with that and tell us how they're going to build the project in their technical proposals. So we'll already have a good idea as to how they're going to be proceeding with the work. It's when they're finally selected that they have to get into the nitty-gritty, the details as to how they're going to access and what they're going to occupy. So we'll get there, and we can certainly give the CONCOMs an opportunity to take a look at those plans to review them.
Okay. I'd like to make a suggestion. Regarding the shade. I would suggest that you do a little study. Go out there this summer, dry your eyes, and the portion of the salt marsh is going to be in the shade. Take a square meter and count how many spark ions there are there. And take a control site further east and do the same thing. Go out there once a year during the local construction process and see what's changed, if anything.
For the purposes of
determining whether the shade has any effect on the marsh.
Well, it will have an effect. We know that.
Okay. But you've offered root mitigation.
We're saying the point we've made with the agencies is that we don't expect the effect to be to adversely affect the functions of the marsh. That's the critical piece.
By changing the coop. It said there could be a change in species predominance.
Or the structure, the plants may grow taller, often under
but
shade.
No adverse impacts.
Species may grow taller, they may grow.
Okay, well, I may ask, do they have that in the order of conditions? You can agree to it now, or.
Are you looking to sort of set a baseline?
I'm looking to set a baseline of what's there now.
Mm-hmm.
How can you determine whether there's an adverse effect if you don't know what's there now?
We've done a full shading analysis on this project. We've met with DEP. We get buy-in from DEP. We've met with DEP.
How much experience does anybody here in this room have with shading of salt marshes?
That's why we meet with DEP. We meet with the Army Corps, and we get our approvals for the shading analysis. That's the process we go through. We're not going to do another shading analysis on this project at this time. We don't have the time to do that.
I think you could go out there in one afternoon once a year and do it. All you got to do is go out there and...
For the purposes of what? If we've already done a shading analysis and we got buy-in from DEP and the Army Corps?
To keep me happy? Because I think there's going to be effects. And I don't see a mitigation plan if there is going to be an effect.
Then we would ask that you submit those comments. comments tell us specifically what it concerns us, we can try to address it. To say that we need to do a study after we've already done a full shading analysis study.
I'm just asking for a baseline. Go out there this summer, take a square meter, count how many salt marsh plants there are in there, what the species are.
Did we do that as part of our analysis?
No.
That's all I'm asking for. Under the bridge and then outside in the control area. Do that once a year while during the construction process. You know, the shading will show up within a year or two, the effect.
Well, it's also very complicated out there because there appear to be some other things happening now. You can see some die-off occurring from, I don't know if it was a spill, I don't know what's going on, but there's some stems that are dying back. So, you know, collecting baseline data, I understand your interest in that. I'm just saying that the interpretation can get really dicey, especially if the effects are minor.
One of the biggest changes is going to be, and I guess that's one of the reasons why you feel so confident in terms of the statement we're making, is that the shading conditions on the other side of the river are the same on one side versus the other in terms of the impact. The salt marsh is much more established and goes much further under the existing structure than it does on the Newburyport side. The difference being that there is no outfall, which is basically bisecting the marsh on the other side, as there is one on this side, and that we're taking away. So probably the biggest modifier that's going on is that freshwater flow, which comes, you know, running through there at high velocities every time there's a significant storm event that doesn't happen on the other side.
Can I make a suggestion? Because it seems to me that a lot of this is speculation about what may or may not happen under the new bridge, and DEP and others have weighed in that there's not going to be a significant impact, and you firmly believe that there's not going to be a significant impact, which is great. But since we have some concern, is it worth just taking some photographs of existing conditions, putting them in a record, and then after the bridge is complete, we would be able to have a compare and contrast. If for some reason everything under the new bridge is dead after a couple of years, well, then we have a photo of before, and we can see what's happened after. Would that in some way address your concern about...
Well, that would help, but I go back to some previous conversations we've had about what's happening under that bridge. And you and I had a discussion under why there's no salt marsh under the existing bridge. Mm-hmm. And scouring from the currents was one of those, from your point of view, why there's no salt marsh there.
You mean, you're talking about
the existing
about
bridge where there's no salt marsh.
Yep.
You could contend with, you know, the scouring, I'm sure the shading has some effect there also.
Yep.
Well, that scouring is going to continue, whether the outfall is there or not. So there's a whole bunch of dynamics out there. I don't think anybody completely understand what's going on out there, which is why I'd love to see a baseline.
And scouring is one of my concerns about...
I don't know, given that enough, we're not required by the DEP to do any salt marsh restoration, and conditions are worse on the Newburyport side than the Amesbury side. We can't predict what the condition of that salt marsh would be, nor can we determine that if the salt marsh doesn't advance as we hoped it would, that the reason is the effects of the bridge project. It could be other natural occurring effects causing that to happen.
Okay, I'm going to
control every single aspect of the natural environment.
If the salt marsh that you're planting, the green area there, doesn't take, and you're doing that because...
We're doing that out of goodwill.
Right.
That's not mitigation for this project.
I understand that. In fact, if that doesn't take, then so be it. It doesn't take.
Correct.
But there's existing salt marsh to the west of that, and there's existing salt marsh to the east of that. All I'm asking for is you do... Go out there, take pictures, whatever, prove what's there now. And 3 years from now, when the bridge is there and it's shaded and everything's dead, well, then we can discuss was that shade or scouring or whatever. But
the point is that what's there now may be diminishing on its own,
right,
due to effects not related to shade.
As part of our proposed project, we're meeting all the performance requirements on this project with DEP and the Army Corps. So as far as what happens after 2017 or 2016, we finish this project, we can't determine whether that's because of the bridge or because it's scour or something else that's going on. So if we meet the performance requirements, it's been determined that we're not going to have an adverse effect. We're providing wetland mitigation. We're providing wetland plantings as a courtesy to the conservation commissions because you requested that. It's not mitigation for this project. So we've already gone a step beyond what we need to do for this project.
I have a question. If it was, if just hypothetically, if the DEP had determined that there would be an adverse effect on the salt marsh, would you then be required to do mitigation, or are you exempt from that?
You would then be in a variance process.
What do you mean?
Salt marsh is a mandatory variance.
So you're not exempt from?
No.
Oh, no. We're saying that we're not required to do it because...
Because it's been approved by DEP.
Right.
Yeah,
with the shading analysis results.
This is a non-limited project because it involves a substantial amount of widening.
Mm-hmm.
So in those situations, the decisions and the performance statements and the variance will be decided by DEP.
So if the salt marsh disappears, and because DEP says there's not going to be an effect.
No, that's not the case. I mean, right now, we're not proposing any effects on the salt marsh. As such, we're not proposing any mitigation for impacts to salt marsh. So with that in mind, this project, as designed and presented, meets all the performance standards in the Wetlands Protection Act. If, at some point in the future, the New Bridgeport Conservation Commission makes the determination that there are impacts to a salt marsh, and that it could possibly be related to the work that we've done, then we can talk about it after the fact permitting. But until then, I'd like to think that we've proven fairly successfully at the state and federal level that they were meeting these required performance standards.
Proving to DEP was not a simple task. I can tell you that. We met with them extensively.
I'm just referring to the literature that you provided where it specifically says spark minor off on the floor is adversely affected by shading. And that's the only literature that we used in your study. I don't see how DEP can reach a conclusion that there won't be any mitigation effects, but so be it.
I think they're saying that the functions and values of that salt marsh, with or without Spartina alternate flora, would not be adversely affected. Is that right?
Well, in this particular location, it will be Spartina alternate flora. But... because Spartina alternate flora occurs on the other bridge, underneath the other bridge, and conditions underneath the other bridge are actually about the same as what will be experienced by these marshes here, is where I'm getting my.
And that the conditions under the eighth bridge was our baseline for
correct
for the shaping.
So we calibrated the model.
Okay. Anything else?
That's it for me, unless there are any other questions.
Are there any storm water or drainage questions? We have Steve Corbin here, one of our consultants who can address those. We've talked to them before, but we didn't know whether there were any outstanding questions, so we brought them to this meeting.
The basins are all going to be built in the first phase of the program of the construction, correct?
Yes.
Between 2013 and 2014.
Yep. And that's one of the activities that takes place in that area. And as you transition, you get the other system in mind at the bottom of the drainage system. So there's separation.
Say that
again. Basically, as we get the new drainage system online, which it will be as we get the first phase of the bridge and the new northbound bridge, we have to have a basin there to tie in the system to the new level. That will be a phase during that first year, we'll quickly build a new outfall and deal with some temporary conditions from the existing. But as we're moving the highway over, some places where the highway is, we have drainage lines underneath. We're not going to have drainage lines running linearly down the highway, so basically we're going to roll them over and get them out from underneath the highway to a new interim condition until it gets to the final condition. But that final condition gets established when the first phase of the roadway is completed. So about the summer of the following year, we'll be using the basin, we'll be using the new outfall, will be on a almost permanent condition, except that where it goes through is where the existing abutment is. So as soon as we get that abutment out of the way, and that final permanent connection is made, but mostly the upland system will be permanent, except there'll be a temporary runaround, because the old abutment structure will be the way for a
second. They have to put grant grants in the beginning as well, because they have to take the bridge construction, they have to control the bridge, so they have to have a place that's built.
Yeah.
So they don't do that.
And 42 the town hall will be in use early on.
Early on. So because we've got to get off that, as I showed you in the plan here, we have to get off the existing system because the new abutment structure cuts off where that pipe is.
Mm-hmm.
So basically, if we start building that structure, we will already have rerouted the pipe temporarily to the new permanent outfall.
Mm-hmm.
We'll build it with maybe 10 or 20 foot of the pipe and everything. There'll be a temporary connection tying into it, and so the outfall will be in operation, taking flows that are there today, and it'll get shifted incrementally two or three more times as we build out the rest of the structure, as we roll the highway over from west to east.
Okay. Thank you.
You're
welcome. The basin being constructed on the water department land,
yes.
Is that outside the 200-foot buffer zone for the riverfront?
Yes.
But there are some other wetland areas within that water department's land.
Kind of like a ravine, which in towards the water. But we're building in the upland area of where the old, they call it the sand filter area. It's in the upland area. It's fairly close to, in terms of the plan here. Here's Pine Hill Ferry Road right here. So about 200 foot down from the bridge location near one of the fire roads. There's the existing crossover old ferries right here. You can actually see down that old right-of-way where some telephone poles are today. So
yeah.
Basically about 150 foot down from that is where the basin's going to be built. That low-lying area actually kind of runs in like here for a bit, and it's kind of a ravine. We're out of that zone. We're building an upland.
Okay. And is there a significant amount of trees and things like that in that area, or is it sparse? Or
I think right in the area, and it's a different tree growth than the areas around it. But I'd have to go, Steve. I'd have to defer to you in terms of
existing vegetation up there.
Yeah,
I believe it's heavily significant size. The Merrimack River is just off the page. This is the grading around the abutments. Here's the basin, and here the resource areas that kind of tie into that surface water course. I think that's probably like what you're referring to. That's just right there. So the green is the limits of the proposed grading. This is the that's the depression for the basin. We're showing you that's just off grading for the shooting bed, which is higher than the basin.
There are trails out there. Is that going to eliminate any of the trails, do you know?
I'm not sure where the trails are. Mm-hmm. Within the water department parcel?
Mm-hmm.
There's a series of like fire roads, and then there's a little spider web of some walking paths.
Yeah,
right. It's probably going to hit. If I remember right, there's a. Can't see it. It might hit one of the walking paths up here, but the carriage roads or the fire roads are there. It doesn't touch any of that.
Thank you.
Any other questions on stormwater?
Were you going to cover any interim repair to the 36-inch, the existing outfall?
In terms of looking at it, well, we actually got back into the staging, as I addressed tonight. The actual outfall itself is one of the first construction works they're going to be working at. The outfall at the head wall's moved, and the pipe has come unearthed a little bit. The area of discharge is basically a lot of large cobbles right now. The material that's gone is not there, so it's all various sized cobbles. The pipe, as it is right now, appears secure. And given the fact that the contractor is going to be out there a year from now, to spend any significant amount of money of reworking that doesn't seem to make good fiscal sense in terms of what should be done. If something happens, of course, if there was further failure, things going on, there'd have to be some type of emergency repairs. But as of right now, we look at that as it's a priority condition that'll, by natural sequence of the schedule, will get addressed by the contractor in the first year that they're out there.
Okay. Do you know we're going to get formal comments back from the city engineer, Derek Wade, on the stormwater comments? I don't know if you've been in touch with him in the last week or so.
The one thing he was waiting for, the state got the right-of-way plans in. Within the next 2 weeks, they're going to be in a position to have worked on basically the right-of-way language and discussions about, it's kind of like a license, basically, because part of the negotiations we have with the water department in terms of relocating their lines, because their lines, his old ferry road right here, besides the power lines that go there, the actual water lines go underneath the highway right there, and actually one of them runs lateral in the state's within the state's right of way, the highway's going to go on top of it. So that's not good practice either. It's bad enough to have a water line transect the highway, never mind run laterally down. So in order to clean up that issue, the project has been willing to run the pipes in a new location and actually run them right along the edge of the right of way on town property. And by running that extra pipe, basically the water department has said, okay, we'll deal with a slope easement and also an easement for the BMP. And basically it was a win-win negotiation in terms of them getting their pipes relocated with the ability to maintain these pipes where other locations, they can't be maintained. They'll be able to traverse the area with equipment as needed. And I think they have a major valving station here. Yeah, one line actually runs down to Merrimack Street through Mosley Woods, and the other line comes up here to tie into to the main service line for the state for the town, as well as a direct line which I think feeds the water tower up on Ferry. So all that was kind of negotiated back and forth, and it ended up being a win-win. And in turn, also it maintained the closed water system that. The water problem is looking for, as opposed to more infiltration. In this way, we basically have a detention pond, and it collects everything here, and it runs eventually out to the 42-inch. So, all those desires were being matched in terms of what the Water Commission wanted, a need that the state had for land. That's how that worked out. So, yeah, sometime during February is when we'll be touching base with the back to John Eric to work us in with the water commission.
And the reason I ask is because I understand you're looking for the commission to close out and be able to make a decision maybe at the 21st, which is their next meeting. And I know John Eric had some concerns and questions about maybe it's a little bit back and forth, a little bit questions about the treatment of the water as it discharges from the Merrimack through this whole system, so, or even the basin. And so just want to make sure that we're able to address whatever comments or concerns he has so that the commission has enough time to look at that feedback from him prior to the next meeting.
I think in terms of where we were, there was some the only issues that came up their meeting was basically the O&M procedure, which we provided a copy of the O&M. The only subtlety to that was besides the O&M procedure, which requires the inspections and clean out of the forebay and potentially the basin, is that as requested, we're going to install a monitoring well. And that monitoring well will be installed actually near term, because we're actually going to go out and do a couple of borings and also install the monitoring well, so baseline data will be created, and that well will be given, and the keys to the cap will be given to the town to do an annual monitoring. If they determine any differences, then that'll have to be dealt with in terms of any concerns. But we walked through all of the concerns that John Eric had in terms of the operations, how it was going to be worked. It's working like all the other basins that meeting current criteria that we have, which get us to the appropriate levels for discharge, and actually goes to the new 42-inch outfall, which is off plan. Through swales and other treatment, it's catching all of the pipe system up here, which was being maintained when, to a certain degree, DEP has been pushing the state to basically do infiltration basins virtually everywhere and get away from the pipe systems because of the concerns of the town and the water commission. The pipe system was maintained here, and this is basically what we thought was the win-win to get us there. I think conditions stating that, systems which are on the Water Commission property, which is not the issue, have to be resolved, but it could be a conditional permit saying that those issues get resolved satisfactorily to move forward. But that's just basically some licensing back and forth and agreements to the concurrence in the O&M procedure, which actually is a newer one, which has just been developed by the state, which matches all their current standards, as well as the one unique thing, which is actually providing the monitoring well, and the state's already agreed to do that.
Yeah, I think we've addressed all his concerns. It's just a matter of getting this final.
Okay. Yeah, the commission is essentially going to be looking for that sort of feedback between the plans, so hopefully we'll be comfortable with the plans and the plan and so forth between now and then. I haven't heard that respond back yet, so just to make sure that you have enough time to get that. The commission's review.
Yeah, we didn't follow with that. Perhaps we should. Would you like us? We had sent a submission to him, I guess.
Yeah, he has a copy, but I just would suggest that basically, like this week, even to make sure he has enough time to look at and give feedback back to the commission. Okay. Again, with the goal of having things in a final format for the commission to review the next meeting. Mm-hmm.
Any other questions? So we're looking for continuance.
Well, as Mr. Pavo has said, we're hoping to close tonight based on conditions. Yeah, if we've met all the CONCOM jurisdictional issues, if there are other concerns for the city, if they want to be made part of conditions, that's perfectly legitimate. Of course, everything has to be taken. And we're not going to build this till we get permission and appropriate licensing from the Water Commission anyway. So I guess we're looking to hopefully close on what's within the purview of the CONCOM Commission.
Right now we're meeting with Salisbury on the 15th, I believe, and it's looking like we're hoping to close on the 15th at Salisbury. We also have a tentative meeting with Amesbury on the 22nd. We're hoping to close on the 22nd. We had a good meeting the other night with them. So if we were to meet on the 21st, it would be great if we could close on the 21st. Hopefully we can address all the issues that all of you have, so that they're closing around the same time. And the reason for that is one of the things we're going to be doing is we're going to have FSD take a look at all of the orders that are coming in from Newburyport, Salisbury, and Amesbury. We're going to be assisting them with writing theirs. We want FSD to try to combine those into common conditions and then also have separate special conditions that are applicable to each town. A couple of reasons for that. One is if you're a contractor out there, you're working in three communities, you don't want to have to look down and see where you're standing to see your order conditions. You have to apply to where you're standing. So we're trying to get some common conditions that everyone can kind of agree to that applies to the whole project, and we'll have specific conditions for each town. That's also going to help out with enforcement, not only for the environmental monitor, but for our staff that's out there trying to deal with one set. They'll still be issued individually by the towns, but we'll try to get as much common ground as we can. So in the next couple of weeks, we'll have FSD take a look at this, try to review all of the comments that came in, and try to come up with one set that we can give to all the agents. And hopefully, if we can all close around that same week, the intent is, you know, that starts that 21-day period where we can try to get an approval under order conditions instead of having everything scattered and having one town trying to keep up with another town.
Yeah.
Well, is there anything else that we wanted? There was just that thing you mentioned about the water department sign off, but we would certainly make that a condition.
Do you expect any changes in the plans between now and then that you submitted in terms of the planting plan, planting schedule?
I think you have the latest iteration, and we have no other plans to change that. That's what we, it had some refinement over the past couple weeks, but you saw the latest version, and. We're as far as, you know, we're closed with Amesbury. That has not been one of the driving issues. So Amesbury, the planting has no comments. So the shores are being treated the same way. So unless there's were some specific changes coming from the CONCOM, the planting plan and the proposed plantings are, you know, that's what we are.
Yeah, it might be the only new information that might come is any modifications to those things that result in conversation with the city engineer and the stormwater side. That sort of new information, but just be able to take in the next part of the meeting.
We'll touch base with them before the next meeting and resolve the issues.
Well, Tim was just saying we're going to be providing a whole new set, right? Yeah. That was your question.
Sorry, I didn't hear what you were asking, Andy. I was just chatting with Diane.
I was just asking, it didn't seem like to me, it doesn't sound like there's any new plans that need to come in for this project from, you know, MassHighway and your consultant's perspective. It's more just a question of making sure our city engineer, his comments are first received by the commission for review to make sure that any concerns he has are addressed. And I just want to make sure that if there's any adjustment that's needed there, that the commission can take those plans in prior to closing the hearing to take them into account in the city.
So then Tim was just wishing in my ear that we're going to get June NOI set. So I just want to make sure if you were asking that question and he's answering it,
right.
I want to make sure that we had that.
Well, that's what I was wondering, because there have been a lot of changes to the plans just over the past week or whatever, and we just got them. So are you going to be issuing a new notice of intent set of plans?
Yes, what we're going to do is it'll be one PDF that we can deliver through that FDP link that I sent you. And it's going to be the same materials that we've submitted to you up to this point, but a little condensed. So it'll be your master NOI copy with all of the language within the data will be updated. And the plan sheets will be updated. So some of the plan sheets that haven't changed may be dated from December. Other plan sheets that have changed will be dated from February.
Good. But we just as long as we have one set of plans to reference or one place to,
We'll print you a hard copy if one's sufficient or hard one you need.
Yeah.
And then also we'll send you an electronic copy. But it's basically the same material that we've given you throughout this process.
So there's nothing new in this.
Yeah. I think we incrementally made some changes. Like we adjusted based on some comments, the 42-inch. You know, we had at one location, we shifted a little bit more to get totally out of the limits in terms of the throat of the splash pad from the salt marsh. Based upon the discussion we had when John Eric came down, we had Julia on the telecon at our office. The issue of the monitoring well came up. We've added that to the plan so that the plan has the monitoring well on it. We can keep a track of all these updates.
Right.
So, as Mr. Dexter said, we're going to take all of them and give you a new base of some plans haven't changed at all. You'll get the whole plan set all dropped into a single PDF document.
Yeah, but it's everything that we've discussed.
Yes.
No surprises.
Wait, coming out of tonight's discussion, I haven't picked up anything that's going to change any plans either.
Right.
So I think all we just need is to get that clean, combined one in for the record. Basically, it's the NOI record set.
Yeah.
Yeah, so every sheet that's been resubmitted since the original package should have a revision date on the top right-hand corner. We're trying to do that in the mind so that every sheet that's been referenced in order of conditions with the applicable date.
I don't really see a reason why we shouldn't close the hearing, and then we can issue the or vote on the order conditions the next meeting.
Well, there's only one other concern that for timing, Joe had mentioned we within 21 days, that doesn't give a lot of time. Or if we were to continue to the 21st, that gives us time to prepare a draft order of conditions that everyone can look at. And at that time, you know, you'd have more confidence in what the order of conditions look like. And if we close on the 21st and everyone was happy, we could issue the order fairly quickly.
Yes, and in the meantime, we can be working on our special conditions. That doesn't have to stop us from.
It makes sense to start on the same timeline or very close for all the time.
Well, what we aim for is just continue this whole thing until the next meeting, and hopefully we'll have an order of conditions typed up that we can vote on that night.
Well, I think what they're actually saying is that what they would like to do is sort of collect from Newburyport, Amesbury, and Salisbury some of our special conditions and our standard conditions to kind of look at together and hopefully get us to a point where each of the three communities can issue something a little bit more.
So 2 weeks may not be enough.
Correct.
Oh, okay.
So if we could close it on the 21st, for example, agreeing that we've addressed all of John Eric's concerns and all of the other concerns of the commission, then we'll probably still be sitting down and going over some of the orders that are common to all the towns in the specific region of towns.
And then we could actually issue the order of conditions within 21 days after that.
Right.
It was my hope that we would have for you at least a draft of that for the next meeting to take a look at.
Because in essence, we're treating that as new information that we want to accept the director.
We still have FSD finalize a lot of the peer review comments that we were asked to do. So asking them to take on this task, we're going to really be pushing as hard as we can to start doing this. But the priority first is to try to close out all of the peer review comments so that we can get at least all of the agents, CONCOM agencies, to agree that we've addressed all of the concerns. The orders are something that's kind of secondary, follows that. So their focus right now is to finalize the peer review comments, but we're going to push them as hard as we can.
I think one benefit too is having FST work with the communities on drafting the order conditions is the overall project deadline, which was tracking on the White House's website. Currently for the order conditions, we're tracking the end of February. So the idea was if we start working with the communities now with FST, we can expedite the drafting of the order conditions, and once we come to those mid-February hearings, we could close and hopefully have those orders of conditions issued by the end of February. And that's the most ideal scenario for us. So I think by working with FST, we can expedite that process, and help alleviate some of the workload that would have been passed around based on the conditions and drafting.
I think it'll be helpful. Yeah, I think it's very helpful.
Okay. I'll make a motion to continue this to the 21st.
Second.
All in favor? Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay.
Thank you.
Why don't we take a 5-minute break? Okay, let's go to enforcement violations. I am recusing myself. Steve, you're up.
Okay.
Some more pictures.
Oh, you did. Mm-hmm. When did you go out there?
January 28th.
Okay.
Things have not gotten any better.
Yeah, I think I was out there last week on the 1st.
Picture on top, you can see on the left, that was the original problem, which they put hay bales in there and kind of created a chute for the water to flow down. And then to the right, you can see.
see the additional erosion which is taking place and coming down. It hasn't flown over the burn yet down into the road, but it isn't going to take much of a storm to do it. So, and then there's a close up of that. I guess I don't know where all the water is coming from. There's going to be something up on the top that needs to be plugged up.
There's also a lot of surface area up there. Frankly, in my opinion, it's not so much that there's anything up there, it's just there's so much land area up there for it to capture the water. And it really shouldn't have placed the fill, the land, the slope and stuff on top of it without actually having time for the city to take up. I don't think there's really any pipes up there that are just trying to.
And the third picture is down where their monitoring wells are. And that third picture was taken on April 23rd, 2006. And notice the tire in the foreground. And then you go to the next one. And you can see that same, I believe it's the same tire. It's pretty much covered up with all the sediment that is washed down. And it's filling in the wetlands.
Is this date right before 23, 2006?
Yes.
Okay.
Well, I haven't gone out there a long time. Okay.
Have you climbed this in every month?
Maybe. Then the next picture is I took the opportunity to walk around on the access road around, and this is some erosion that is taking place. Uphill from that road, and then if you turn around and look down to the bottom, you can see that the sediment is washing down into the wetlands. So there's something else that you can fix. And then the next picture is in another area where it's very obvious that the sediment is washing down into the wetlands.
Could you email me these?
Sure.
I was out there last week and I had some similar photos. And I sent an email to Chip Nylon and explained, thanks for putting up some hay bales, but there needs to be a little bit more done and in some more areas as well. So he said he'd get back to me. And wasn't able to get in touch with them today to find out what their plan of action is going to be, but it would be good to have some of these additional pictures that you have, too.
The other issue is, and I think I'm right on this, that pipe that is down there on that end of the crow lane is supposed to be overflow from the detention basin.
Yeah.
So there shouldn't be any water coming out of it right now.
And one of your issues that was pointed out, the enforcement on our pre-request, was that they come to the commission meeting and talk about it and address that issue. I don't think we received anything back about it, but it was pointed out the enforcement has been one of the concerns that need to be addressed.
Okay, so we need to get them to come.
Yeah, because it was called out as being both the erosion issues, both discharge at that location, called out the plan, just called it discharge, and then called the comments are oxide, but we're really not convinced that
I think it smells a little sulfur. Put my nose right down in it. But the other thing is that there shouldn't be any water coming out of there right now. Because that detention basin, as far as I know, they've got that end of the pipe still blocked up.
Well, your next meeting would be the third meeting, I think, since you've issued the enforcement order that they have not actually done that. I don't know if that, something to call for their attention as far as fines per day and not response. I mean, clearly, there's some room.
The other issue out there is also that little burn that's been around the end of the pipe there. That's all on city land. I mean, it's not our jurisdiction, it's not our issue. But it's all on city property. I mean, it's right in the crow lane right away.
Are you talking about the depression right before the road, the access road goes up and to the right to go around the landfill that down there?
Yeah.
That's what you're talking about. Okay.
That whole mess is city land.
The mirrors were the issue because we have Dr. Adams showing in the photographs of both I'm taking and those you've taken, and there's an excellent piece of more useful ones. I know I had copied or sent a copy of the enforcement of the DEP. I don't know if there's been any follow-up since. I think part of the goal was to make sure the DEP was that they were aware that there's actually a good consultation down there beyond their own enforcement order that they actually pay attention to. And I, it's not just something that we see in the person who are the DEP and are not getting any attention from them, but the organization also cares since they've made an order on this project about following up with them. So I don't know. They probably have any response back from the DEP on that, but presumably they would be responding to and saying, oh, you know, we actually put an order on this project. You know, you need to do something about this location. So maybe we should forward these photos to them as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think everyone should be very concerned because, like you were saying, Steve, it's not as though it's been very wet.
Yeah.
This is a lot of erosion for almost no precipitation at all, and it's not spring yet. So I think
it's been heavy snow and melting, which there will be at some point.
Yeah.
I just don't understand why they placed all the loan without actually waiting for it to see. I mean, it didn't make any sense to do it since I'm a freshman, or knowing it wasn't going to be a time to take. So it looked like it was being closed off, this project, but it's not really being closed off if it's not.
And if we send a note to New Ventures saying, you know, you haven't been at our meeting, that's a question, that should be CC'd to DEP as well.
Right. And you mentioned that, I guess if they don't show up at the next meeting, we can start finding them retroactive to those first photos I took with December 27th.
You can find them every day since the enforcement opposition.
Okay. I thought it was only the state.
Well, they're actually, it's not just like the enforcement. I mean, first of all, they've got a permit issued by the DEP for their project, which they're in violation of because they're causing erosion on the property. But also, you're just issuing enforcement required based on erosion on the city's property, which is not part of their project. So, you know, I mean, you've got multiple levels, and I think it's full within your jurisdiction to say, we have jurisdiction over. The reason why we should the DP is aware is because I think we actually we put the two file numbers and multiple file numbers in the enforcement order to cover anything that was other permits, whether or not the DP or not. So they're causing erosion or location on there. It's not even part of the venture's property. So, you know, it's not like we're just covering the DP superseding order. We're actually covering on whatever was never covered under their permit. So.
Everybody okay with that?
Okay. All set?
Yeah.
All right. Other items, the MACC annual conference is coming up on March 3rd. I will be going. If anybody else wants to go, we can coordinate. They upped their rates to $110 now.
Mm-hmm. The commission will take over.
Yes. So let me know, and we can head on in. Next is the discussion on the Woodman possible 40B project. I put some maps out there from that I put together from the previous submissions they had done. And I got them into my GIS over the past couple of days. What I figured is, if they do anything like this, it's the filling is going to be on the order of 20,000 square feet. It appears they may be able to do it. I can't imagine that they're going to get. I'm sorry, I only printed out five copies. From what I'm reading so far, if it's their property, they'll have a right to access the uplands, but they have to meet all the standards. It's not limited to the five. It would probably be a limited project, and it's not limited to the 5,000 square feet. This is obviously not a good place for any development.
And actually, last time we were discussing this, even though it would be a limited project to gain access, crossing the wetlands would not be enough to let them put in a bridge or a road or just a culvert through it. It has to be a much bigger opening.
To connect the two sides of the wetlands? Okay.
What's the definition of a limited project, or why is this limited?
There's no other way to get there.
In the regs, certain things are called limited projects, which means you can allow them regardless of their impacts. You still condition them, and they have to provide mitigation. But so the 5,000 square foot of BBW rule wouldn't apply. They could have 20,000 square feet of BBW impact, and we would still technically have to allow the project if they were able to mitigate it.
But they would have to replicate the 20,000.
They would have to replicate it, yeah.
And I'm meaning to look up what percentage of a replication actually survives, what the averages are.
Normally we would require 2-to-1.
Yeah.
You know?
What was the proposed originally? Was it 2-to-1 or was it just a 1-to-1?
1-to-1. And that wasn't even, was that even in the, that was only in the first project. They didn't even show any replication.
There isn't actually land area available up and actually available to do a 2-to-1 to draw their plans. Mm-hmm.
Is there any land left for stormwater management?
Right.
Is the woodland?
Well, presumably they're going to say underground infiltration, but of course we question, is stormwater wise, we question, is there actually capacity for the land to absorb that water?
Mm-hmm.
Is the ownership of the Woodman parcel at the moment still the same as the ownership of the Tropic Star backland?
Mm-hmm.
Well,
why is it not the same land?
It's different parcels, but it is the same owner.
Well, then, how can they cut off their access by selling this to Tropic Star and then claim we don't have any access except on the wetlands?
Well, they wouldn't have access through there either. That's all wetland in the middle there. That's all wetland to the and the property on the left. That it doesn't show in the state thing,
doesn't
but
show on this.
It pretty much will. Michael Seacamp basically called the whole farmed area a wet meadow. So it's wetlands. We walked out there.
And I understand. I agree with your concern there. Keep in mind the fact that Seaport could just go, Woodman, we've got the ability now left to see if our church refuses to buy from them. They buy it from Woodman. They effectively own the parcel without owning adjacent land, and they say, well, we can't get access to our backland without going through the wetlands. So they have a very easy way to get to that point at this point.
Well, it would seem like the easiest way to at least hopefully prevent this would be to pass the ordinance with the 25-foot no disturbance around the wetlands, and then
well,
except
I think
that it's a local, that's the local ordinance. If they do a 40B, then it doesn't.
Well, according to the stuff that Joe passed out, if you get the Zoning Board of Appeals to agree with this.
Oh, well, exactly. It's the work to get the ZBA to administer it.
Joe and I have talked about this, but I just want to give you sort of my perspective on it. One, you definitely should use this as a leverage to get the debate, that's the ordinance, and get that through. But keep in mind that just because the ZBA supports it, they of course will, they'll say, the Housing Appeals Committee, which the developer will vote right to, will override all that, you know, just allow the project to proceed because the developer will say, well, we can't make it economically feasible without putting parking and buildings in a no-disturb area. So ZBA, I'm sure, will back you up on that. I'm not questioning that. It's just that the developer has a very easy way out of that, which is by going to the state. So, yes, you make it harder for them, but not very much the way that the state works.
What about the issue of flooding down the industrial park, which is specific?
Again, unfortunately, the Housing Appeals Committee is not a bunch of engineers, so no matter how good whatever study we do, they still say, well, the developer's got another engineer that says something different, and we'll think the engineer's word.
Yeah, but my understanding is that, any local ordinance aside, they have to file under the state regs, and that is not part of the single application.
That's true.
And that does not get appealed to.
Oh, right. That is the leverage we have, is the state act. They have to comply with that.
Yeah.
And something like this is going to be pretty...
Yeah.
Pretty good.
If we have the local ordinance of the 25% no disturb, they might be forced to make it a little bit smaller.
But my thought about this the whole time has been, this is pretty much maximum build out they could do out there.
Oh yeah.
It's their starting point. In a lot of places they'll back off and do less. But this is, they're gonna maximize it and then figure out what they can do, what they can actually get through. The other issue is it's a single egress. It's a lot of housing for a single road. Now, if the city got the other Woodman parcel, that would cut off one of the egress points. But the Millens are the property to the north of that. The Millen property used to be Eleanor Woodman's property, and I believe the Millens are. They're all related.
Well, they could gain access
to the south
road,
too.
Putting the road in by the farm stand.
Right. That would be the one to the north,
right.
Even though that may all be wetlands too. I would assume that field is all wetlands too.
It's all wetlands, yeah.
So it's totally surrounded by wetlands, but they do have something to the south that they could possibly get an easement through to get to Crow Lane. So, it's possible.
Crow Lane?
Yeah, look.
There's a piece of property there.
There's that piece, JLB or something.
To this side of the landfill?
Right,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, so that's certainly a possibility.
Mm-hmm.
So, and that would depend on whether they wanted to...
Not that Crow Lane is... particularly suited to having that much car traffic on
a daily. Right. No, it's a mess too. But who knows where this is going to end up. But tomorrow night there's going to be the Affordable Housing Committee is meeting. I happened to talk to Judy Timon yesterday, who was on that, and I sent her that map that I printed out. Just looking for that, so there'll be a discussion there.
Well, it's going to be a while before it goes anywhere, right?
Probably. The issue that Judy was saying is that they're having trouble selling affordable housing units. There are several empty here because people who are making that kind of money aren't getting loans to buy them. So. What are they going to do? They're going to build this thing with what, 10%, 20 affordable housing units?
We also heard from the attorney the other day that 40B applications are starting to pick up a bit. And so, it's hard for me to gauge, of course, what the economy is, but, if they are picking up, maybe that's developers saying, we need those restrictions, we can get help with financing and whatnot, that maybe the 40B is still the easy way around loan zoning, restrictions.
Yeah, so we may have a fight on our hands, but our state mandate still applies. So I guess it's certainly a very wet area. So they'll have to do 20,000 square feet of pervious pavement. Just kidding.
If we're lucky, maybe the wetlands have expanded out there over the past.
Well, that's the other issue.
It's been a long time since they delineated.
I would bet a lot of money since that landfill has gotten capped that those wetlands are not anywhere near what they were. I'll bet they're a lot bigger. Which, and they probably haven't even done another delineation. Of course, with this, the project that I put on here, the wetlands, that they just ignored the wetlands in the field. They just called the field upland, as opposed to the first one they did, where they actually did a delineation and found all that to be wet.
Well, and this would be a case where we would ask for funds to have a wetland review, obviously, with the delineation.
Yeah.
So.
And then we need green roofs.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, was there a file on your office on any of the previous attempts?
There's an AMF. There's one AMF in 2004.
Right. Yeah, you might check that and see if there's any information on the type, the animal life that uses that area. Because we were looking at something, and that's what said. That you could not have just one or two colors.
Back then, there was. That was part of the priority habitat. It is not anymore. Mr. Rogozin at the DEP moved it down to Crow Lane. That would have stopped us in its tracks if that was still in effect. But he did not believe that Sioux Speak had found blue-spotted salamanders on Crow Lane, so he stopped it there. Which is probably why they didn't really fight too hard for it then, because that would have that would have killed it. But that was then, and this is now. Okay. Are we all set on that for now? Okay. Wastewater treatment facility?
Yeah, Peter Hartford sent an email today just letting us know that they're going to request an amendment to the order of conditions because they need to put in a radio tower, a smallish radio tower, but nevertheless it would be in the buffer zone behind the building just next to the aeration building. So it won't be any further into the buffer zone than the aeration building. It'll be right next to it and sort of just in line with it. So it'll consist of a concrete pad and a tower on top.
Okay,
so
how big is the concrete pad?
I don't know. We haven't gotten those details yet. But he emailed a plan, a sort of a rough sketch of where it's going to be. It looks relatively minor. So I said, just put it in writing, the request for an amendment, and they need to expedite it. So I said, well, we can put it on the agenda at our next meeting, and it shouldn't be a problem. Seems relatively minor, so I just want to let you know, give you the heads up that that'll be coming for the next meeting, and just in case anybody had any concerns right off the bat that they want me to convey to Peter.
What's it for?
It's for communications in the building. I guess for the. Do you remember this, Andy? Is it for the networking?
Well, they have some monitoring systems that they have to keep track of.
Don't know how tall it is, but he did mention that it should be sufficiently screened from view from public ways and from also from the pedestrian ways. So hopefully it wouldn't have too much of a visual impact either.
Screen branches. Could it go on the roof of the building?
Well, then it would, and everyone would be looking at it all the time. Yeah, no, I don't, and plus the roof probably isn't designed to carry the weight of something like that.
Sounds pretty benign, but you think for communications in that area, you would need a radio tower, I mean. Isn't there technology that it's a little more sophisticated than that?
I don't know. You can explain the reason.
And if you can have a wireless network in your house without wires, then why would it
be
a radio tower?
Well, every time I drive down past in that little area, if I'm listening to the radio in my car,
you know
it goes all static.
That's true, mine does too.
Yeah, and I don't feel like it's a voice guard.
Yeah, maybe.
So maybe there's some.
Okay.
in that area that they need to do.
Coast Guard's blacking out communications because of their sensitive
things.
Right on the coast.
Right. Right.
So that's all that is. It's just a heads up that'll be coming for the next meeting in the form of a request for an amendment.
Maybe we could require them to put an osprey nest on top.
I think it's a pretty straightforward request. It's a pretty minor adjustment.
Yeah,
totally
not that tall of town.
Yeah. So that's that. And then the one last thing is, I was mentioning to Joe earlier, 9 Graff Road, a gentleman has a business there, Dugan Supply, and this is his building. In front of the building, there's a drainage swale, and he wants to put a pipe in. Apparently, he requested this last year.
Mm-hmm.
If you might remember, there was a site visit, and the general consensus was absolutely not.
He had other things he wanted to do besides the pipe.
He says he doesn't want to maintain, or he can't maintain the swales, and so it would just be easier for him if he could just have the water go through a pipe, and then he could landscape. And I said, I'm guessing that the answer is still going to be no, but that I would check with you regarding the reasons that you objected last year, just to remind him of what those are. If you can, any of you can remember the site visit, or...
It's probably in the minutes.
Do you think he came to a meeting?
I don't know. I know we went out there.
I'll try and look it up in the minutes.
Yeah, I can't recall whether it was because it was linked with something else.
7
Yeah, it wasn't just one thing. There were several things he was looking to do.
I think he wanted to change the entrance way.
He wants to shift the entrance over a little bit.
Yeah.
Sounds like. I wonder if this is the same as last time.
Yeah, it may be the exact same thing. Extend parking on north side of building 5 spaces. Grant for.
I think it was informal. I think we just talked to him
mm-hmm.
informally. And,
mm-hmm.
never filed anything.
Oh, well, maybe that was the issue.
Yeah, that's what he did. He wanted to get a sense of what you all thought about it last year before he wasted time submitting an application. And he said that you all said that it wasn't going to be approvable. And he's coming back now to sort of ask again.
If we mend it?
Yeah. and what those reasons were for not allowing.
I doubt we would have, if he'd just come in informally, that we would have said that we couldn't approve it.
I guess it would be at the site visit, Mary told him no. So he wanted to know. I don't know if anyone, any of you can remember, but I'll get back to him.
I think it was a pretty strong consensus for the folks that were out there on the site visit. Highly doubtful.
Yeah.
Not recommended.
Mm-hmm.
Not a recommended
so
approach.
So
you
never went any further?
Yeah.
It's a plumbing supply. They want to plumb things.
Right. He's probably got a lot of extra
pipe.
He's
got a lot of pipe. He must have used something.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Well, we'll try and look at those notes and see if we have anything on that.
Mm-hmm.
That's about it. Anybody have anything else?
Motion to
adjourn.
I just want to mention the open space plan. As you're looking at that, as it's starting to get right around, there's a public hearing coming up on the 16th. And there's the survey, the space recreation survey will be online. We'll start getting the mail today. So we'll fill that out for people who are interested in parks and open space, public survey, and have it for everybody.
Yeah, Mary Harbaugh sent me the notice on that, but the flyer attached wasn't there. So I asked her for that, and when she sends that to me, I'll send it out to everybody.
Good thing I didn't spend time looking for the plan.
Yeah, exactly. It wasn't there.
Did we go to the meeting on Thursday? The subcommittee?
More the merrier, as far as I'm concerned.
They're going to be discussing the ordinance, right?
They are good. Gary told you they'd be just so if you can make it, 7:00. Same place, same bat channel. I second that motion. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Was that an opposed, Dan?
That was not an opposed.
The